digital radio, colorfulradio.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
The Health Secretary admits emergency care has not been acceptable in recent weeks. Steve Barclay says what he calls the worst flu season for 10 years has made this winter particularly tough. The government will introduce new legislation today for minimum safety levels during industrial action. The bill would ensure vital public services maintain a basic function when workers go on strike. Fans queued to buy a hardback copy of the Duke of Sussex's autobiography as it hit shelves at midnight. Shops across the country reopened in the early hours. The government's promised to help businesses with their energy bills for another year, but significantly reduce the amount of support they'll get. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has been explaining why the level of help has dropped.
Lower because gas prices have come right down. But I am concerned, even though wholesale prices are lower than before Putin invaded Ukraine, a lot of businesses have yet to see the benefit of that in the bills they actually pay.
From Radio News Hub, I'm Andy Hoyle.
This winter, count on EE to lighten the load with 336 pounds off the awesome Samsung Galaxy S22. And that's not all. You'll also get the amazing Chromebook 4 worth 299 pounds at no extra cost. Wow! What a perfect way to ease into the new year. And it's all on the UK's best network, but only until January 24th.
£30 up front, 125 gig. CPR plus 3.9% increase each March. Best for network performance. Verified ee.co.uk/claims. 24 months. Terms apply.
Colourful. Coming up next. Colourful. Julius. Colourful.
Colourful
Radio.
Colorful
Radio.
Africa in Focus is sponsored by Dermadew Lotion. Visit dermashark.co.uk.
Colorful
Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, or even good evening, depending on the time zone that you are connecting to us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus, and I'm your host, Julius Baluto. Once again, this wonderful, wonderful week, we are so blessed hosting great Kenyan. He's done a lot in terms of contribution to schools across the world. And his name is Professor Ken Kamoche. And he's not just doing what he's a scholar for, but he's doing beyond. So he's a management scholar, but also at the same time, he's also a fiction writer. Welcome to the show, my brother.
Thank you very much, Julius. Thanks a lot for having me on the program.
Yes, right then. So say a quick hello to our listeners and introduce yourself more than I have.
Right, okay. Yeah, my name is Ken Kamoche, born and raised in Kenya, and that's where I went to school and university. I studied accounting and finance at the University of Nairobi, worked for a little bit in auditing for the then Price Waterhouse. And then I earned a scholarship to come here to the UK, to Oxford University, where I did a master's degree with the intention of finishing that and then going back to a career in auditing. But things changed and I found myself drawn to research. So I stayed on and did a doctorate in human resource management. So I changed tack completely from accounting finance to human resource management. And perhaps I'll say a little bit more about that later on. And I've been working ever since as an academic. So I first worked at the University of Birmingham for a number of years. And then I found that I was doing a lot of work in Asia, traveling occasionally to places like Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and so forth. And I decided to make a move to locate myself in that part of the world for a number of years. So I ended up living in Hong Kong. And again, I will say a little bit more about that later on. And that's why I got interested in writing this particular book that we'll be talking about, Black Ghosts. I then decided to move back to the UK and have been here at the University of Nottingham. Well, first I went to Nottingham Trent and then moved to the University of Nottingham, where I am Professor of Human Resource Management and Organizational Behavior. I also direct a group called the Africa Research Group, which is a community of scholars who have an interest in Africa. We do a lot of work on China-Africa relations. And I also write fiction. I've been writing fiction since I was a little boy, plays, short stories, and more recently, novels. So that's me in a nutshell, Julius.
Well, what you didn't say, Ken Kamoche, is that also it's not just Black Ghost. You've also written two more books.
Yes, my first work of fiction was actually a collection of short stories called A Fragile Hope. And that was stories that I wrote mostly when I lived in Hong Kong, because that's when my fiction writing career really took off. They were published in various magazines and various journals, such as Ambit, Kuna Pipi, New York Stories, and so forth, Wow Literature Today. And at some point I decided I have about a dozen stories. Why not just put them in a book? And so I got a publisher here in the UK. They produced it in 2006, I believe it was. It did reasonably well. It was shortlisted for the Commonwealth First Book Award. I think I won. Shortlisted, didn't win. But one of the stories won something called the Olauda Equiano Prize for African Writing. I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with the Olauda Equiano. He wrote a fantastic book many, many years ago, the first African to have written a book, I believe. It's a story about himself. So that was my first work of fiction. I then wrote a book about the experiences of a Kenyan who had moved to the UK. I called it True Warriors. That book is now being revised and will hopefully come out sometime later this year. Slightly different title, but it's about these relations between Kenyans and the people here in the UK. When I moved to Hong Kong, that's when I started writing my third book, which is The Black Ghost. And this is one that is about Africans in Asia, specifically China and Hong Kong. So that's my work of fiction, basically.
Like, what does your job as a professor entail? How does it look like? What does it entail? Yeah.
Well, it's a day like any other. That normal day, I start off by I make breakfast for myself and the kids, send them off to school. Then if I'm working at the office, which is we're coming back to that normal, it's about getting to the office and perhaps teaching a class. In fact, this morning I taught a 3-hour class on management and organizations, the main MBA program. And you interact with the students. It's a very interesting. We had a very interesting conversation about how to structure businesses. And in fact, you know, these days, as we're coming out of the pandemic, we still face challenges. Organizations still face challenges about how they can get people back to work. People have been used to, remote working, blended learning for students, and so forth. It will be a day that will see me either meeting with students or colleagues. Also doing research. Doing research is a very significant part of what we do. At the moment, I'm doing a study on scaffold workers and the knowledge that they create. Just to give you a bit of context, when I lived in Hong Kong, I mean, some of my work is still inspired by my days there. It was quite normal to have people come and fix something. If you live in a high rise, which is typically what everybody does, maybe something's broken down, the aircon unit, and a guy comes along and to fix the aircon, and he builds a scaffold hanging out of the window, bamboo scaffold. And I remember this guy coming around to fix this structure, and I asked him, "Are you scared?" And he said in very good English, "I'm a scaffolder." He didn't have to say anymore. It meant, this is who I am. That's my identity. So I just got interested in what is the life of these people who live on that periphery, on the margin of society, pretty much in a sort of a career which is seen as low status, but it's actually reasonably well paid. So years later, we started doing this study, speaking to these people, finding out what it's like hanging out there against a high-rise wall. And so we've completed the study and we're writing up the piece of paper, the paper now. So that's some of the things that I do. I also do a lot of work on China-Africa. As I mentioned, I'm director of the Africa Research Group. So again, the question here is, what are the motivations for Chinese businesses to invest in Africa? What is that like? But it's also a question as to how does it impact people's lives, African economies? Is it a force for good or not? And how can African economies and African countries put themselves on a level playing field? How can they negotiate on an equal footing? Because there are serious issues about how this engagement happens. So these are some of these that actually motivated me to locate my novel, partly in Africa, in Zimbabwe specifically, and partly in China.
So
teaching and research are the key issues that keep me busy during the day.
Indeed. Now then, let's come to the book. In Africa, when you say, you just say the word black ghost, it is definitely the connotation is tossed a bit negative. And because you begin then to hear people talk like Jesus is white, the devil is black, normal markets have got a nice name, but when it comes to dodgy markets, they are black markets. And therefore you can go on and on drawing the distinction between black darkness as a connotation of evil. Apparently, I think also the devil, they draw the devil with he's horns, kind of black with some horns. And so when the moment you say black ghost, immediately there you are like scaring me. I'm just wanted to give you some like feedback. Of course, then you are here with us, which is brilliant, and our listeners know you're here with us. Why Black Ghost is a title?
That's a very good question. Now it's a simple answer to that. One of the first things I discovered when I moved to Hong Kong was this idea of the black person as an alien, as the other, often struggling to fit in society. And I discovered that there was actually a word for black people, and that was, surprise, surprise, black ghosts. In Cantonese, it was hagwai, which means black ghost, literally. In Putonghua, it is hegui. Now, these are words that are obviously derogatory, but they become more or less normalized to the extent that even the black and white people who are seen as the other in those countries, in those parts of the world, actually use those words to describe themselves. They do it ironically. So you'll find, for example, the typical word guailo in Cantonese simply means a white ghost, but it's often used specifically to refer to, foreigners in general. So you'll hear foreigners referring to themselves as guailo. They've normalized and sanitized what is obviously a derogatory term, and it has come into common parlance. So I use that word or that term because I wanted to highlight the plight of black people in Asia, specifically in China. And those are the words that I used. Now, no one actually referred to me as a black ghost, not to my face anyway. But you will hear the word used, you'll hear those words used, and you know that they exist. And even though they've been sanitized, they of course still paint you as an outsider. And I found it was important for me to use those particular words. I use them ironically, obviously, but that is what it means. It doesn't mean that you're a ghost, but there was this view, ages ago, as I understand it, that in China foreigners were seen as ghosts or devils, the barbarians, and the Chinese did a lot to try and keep themselves safe, including building a wall. The Great Wall of China was essentially built to keep out foreigners, from Mongolians, and others from the north. So that mindset is still very much there, and it's unfortunate. But it was important for me to highlight these, and much of the novel is about the black people finding a place for themselves in China, first as students, settling down into a world of work, the social life, the dating life, going out, getting married, putting down roots, So the story is not just about the challenges that Black people face in China and Hong Kong. It is also about the opportunities that they find, the lives that they create for themselves. It's about love, finding love, losing love, and trying to find it again, and so forth. So it's about people interacting.
This is Colorful Radio. Colorful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At DermaShack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, DermaDew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturizer. So why don't you try our cream, DermaDew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturization. DermaDew, total body cream, complete moisturization.
Well, quite true. You see, the thing is, when we talk about discrimination, when we talk about racism, most of the time, the focus has not been very much on the Asian continent. It's been on the Western capitals. Yeah, and probably there's a reason for that, because from the Western capitals, London, came colonialism, which went everywhere. From capitals like New York, and of course, you know, slave trade happened, Africans being victims. And therefore, probably that's the reason as to why. It's obvious suspects. You think, oh, Western capitals. But what you are telling us is happens in Asian continent too.
I think the first point to note is the beginning and the motivation for the story. And you know, that goes back to my own interactions, if you like, with Asia, which I'll come to in a minute. But just pointing out that, yes, we recognize the West as the seeming center. It's what we're familiar with, you know, coming from Africa, because of the obvious colonial links. And this is why we speak English. This is why some people in some other parts of Africa, you know, speak French. There's that heritage and that colonial baggage. But it is also the idea that when you look around, what we define as a Black diaspora, the Africa diaspora, essentially refers to Africans who moved west, partly because of those colonial linkages, but also because this was the part of the world that was accessible. When I look back at my members of my own family who, in the early days after independence, were acquiring opportunities to go and study in the United States, because that was available. It was a route that was open. The doors that were open, that became the norm. People heading off to the United States, and increasingly, more recently, to the UK and other parts of Europe. That's what we see as the opportunities for Black people who want to venture out. You hardly ever see, or I hardly ever saw, people going east. And that became, I think, for me, an important question when I first moved to Hong Kong and discovered that there was a small community of Black people there who had initially gone to study in China and decided to settle in that part of the world. There were very few, but they told me very interesting stories about their lives there. But the other point I want to mention is my own initial interactions, you know, hearing about Asia. When I was a little boy, you know, my grandmother had a friend who went to South Korea and came back to Kenya speaking Korean and, you know, bringing back these elements of Korean culture. And I was quite taken by that. I was like, wow, this is interesting. One day I want to go and visit this place for myself. But then I developed those ideas even further when I went to Oxford and started researching Japanese management. I spent a month in Japan as a master's student, just learning more about the Japanese culture. And in particular, how it was, why it was that Japan was doing so well, was succeeding. You know, Japan was everything Japanese, from products, gadgets, everything high quality was Japanese, vehicles. And so my question was, why was that? So I thought it would be interesting for me to actually go there and see for myself. But I was also looking at various other social connections. I don't know if you remember, there was a marathon runner, Kenya marathon runner, Douglas Wakehori, who had spent time in Japan, and he was talking about how the culture had shaped him. And there was a guy called a car racing driver, a guy called, I think, Patrick Giro, who had also spent time in Japan. And these were people who somehow remotely I was relating to and were inspiring me and making me wonder, what is it about the Asian culture that is turning these guys into heroes?
Yeah.
So I wanted to go and find out for myself. So that's why I spent some time in Japan and then later to China. So there was that personal intellectual curiosity about those cultures, especially for a country like Japan that had never really been colonized, occupied by the United States, but they found their own way. They retained their own culture and they became an economic force in spite of those challenges and humiliation in the Second World War.
Indeed. Professor, I know this is very important. And when we talk about also the sanitization of derogatory words into being accepted by a community. I mean, with the best example we can give is the US, whereby black people never find offense calling each other the N-word, and they are comfortable. But let someone who is not within that circle, they are called. They'll be sued in every court.
Yeah. That's right. They have sanitized it for themselves.
It
becomes acceptable. Rap artist, it becomes, you know, derry girl. Exactly. You refer to yourself as such.
Yeah, you hear them comfortably calling each other my nigga, all these things, or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's normal, it's accepted, but within only one group of people. So therefore, black ghost in the China, it's amazing. But of course, your book exposes, of course, these kind of moments of discrimination. Maybe could you just tell us a bit what the book is really focused on?
Okay. The story starts in Zimbabwe. I have a character called Dan Chiponda who secures a scholarship to go to China. I mean, he wants to go to the West like everyone else. He's been hearing about, you know, people who've secured scholarships to go to Canada and the US. And that's what he hopes for, as many people do, young people growing up in Africa. But the one that comes up, you know, his school teacher says to him, well, I'm afraid the only one available now is China, you know, are you going to take it? He's reluctant, but he wants to see the world. So he takes this opportunity. So he's willing to discover and explore and find a way to, you know, help his family. His family are squatters on a white farm. And clearly this is at about the time Zimbabwe became independent. So his father in particular sees his son, Dan Chiponda, is a person who is going to elevate them. You know, he's going to help them emerge from these from the doldrums of poverty. So that's how the story starts. So when he goes to China in the late 80s, comes face to face with discrimination, but also interesting opportunities. So it isn't just a sad story of this African who suffers in China. No, in fact, what I found speaking to my African friends in Hong Kong was that they had some really exciting opportunities to create a capitalist world for themselves in this communist environment. They were provided with grants that were very generous because, you know, the Chinese authorities had to make it worth their while. Otherwise, they wouldn't have lasted. So they had money on their hands. And part of the problem was that because they had better grants, they had a better lifestyle, and that created resentment among some of the male students. So issues about, oh, these African guys are taking our girls, or they have all these nice clothes, and they think, you know, they who do they think they are? Those sorts of resentments, I think, were happening. And that, for me, creates an interesting opportunity to examine those conflicts. And then I heard about an incident that supposedly took place in the city of Nanjing, where local students clashed with African students over some issue, possibly a minor issue, some misunderstanding in a student party, but it then escalates into a major clash, and that was actually a historical incident. It happened like 6 months before the Tiananmen massacre. So it was a big story. It wasn't very well reported. In fact, I remember watching the Tiananmen massacre thing as a student at Oxford, but there was no mention of any issue or any involvement of African students. So for me, this was a really interesting anchor, and I wanted to see how that might help to shape the story. And that's how it continues. So the Africans are fighting their way in this society. They're also struggling with their studies. And then it's about how this character then decides to move to Hong Kong, where his future is, he sees a better future, especially with his girlfriend, who is Chinese. They'll receive much, you know, they'll be more accepted. They'll fit in much better because, you know, Hong Kong was a British colony. And so many of them are sort of navigating their way away from China to Hong Kong, and that's where I then start examining what those lives are like at the turn of the millennium. They're succeeding in business, they're fitting into the society, they are still struggling to get accepted. That never really goes away, but they are also harking back to and looking for connections with their previous life in China. So in fact, one of the really interesting things that happens is, somebody who used to be a friend of theirs, used to run a bar on campus, then emerges. You know, he turns up suddenly unannounced, and I'm not going to say very much about what happens, but this changes everything for this group of people, because just to point out that the Chinese guy sees himself now as a reincarnation of Admiral Zhang He. Zhang He is this gentleman, this seaman who traveled to the east coast of Africa several hundred years ago, supposedly some 70 or so years before Vasco da Gama reached the east coast of Africa. So there's a China-Africa connection there that has not really been understood. And this guy is coming back and saying, you have to take us to Africa. We're going to do Africa. And I thought, I saw that as an opportunity to capture this China-Africa engagement more broadly, and the adventure then begins.
Colorful radio.
Colorful
radio.
Wow, sounds very exciting. I can't wait to go to the end of the back page. You know, right. It's very exciting, very exciting. You know, it's interesting also because one of the things we are learning is that whichever corner you go around the globe, black people, the way they call them, people of color, I don't have any worry about whichever I use, but it looks like no safety in terms of acceptance tends to be an issue. And of course, I think when you wrote this novel, I'm sure you are aware of during COVID-19 what was happening in China.
Yeah.
Could you share maybe a bit?
Yeah. I was here in the UK, obviously, during the COVID, but I'm aware of what was happening, particularly in Guangdong province, where, you know, you saw reports of Africans being thrown out of their homes, being blamed for spreading COVID, and bearing the brunt of the pandemic. And I mean, this was in 2020 and 2021, mostly in 2020. And you're thinking, why is that happening today? In all fairness, I mean, you know, Africans have settled in China for years now. There's actually a huge African community in Guangzhou, which is where the big city in Guangdong province. I think they call it Africa Village or something. And where, you know, Africans are running businesses, they're thriving, they're doing all kinds of things, they're settling in the society. They've put down roots, raising families. And so the idea that they were targeted and blamed, it was just very difficult to understand and to believe. But this is what was happening. But in some ways, it did not surprise me, you know, given the time that I spent in Hong Kong and China. I traveled extensively in China during those years. It did not surprise me that this kind of violence was visited upon Africans. It just seemed like something that would happen in our society, because there are very few protections, as you point out. The law is, to my mind, lax when it comes to the protection of foreigners. They are an easy target, and it's the society finds it easy to justify, even though these are the people who had not left the country. They'd been there the whole time. These were people who possibly were the least likely to be spreading COVID. You don't know, but they were blamed. And I think that highlighted the fact that, as they say, things change, but they don't always change. You know, plus a chance, plus c'est la même chose, as they say in French. So though there has been progress, really, at the end of the day, that progress is questionable, because when it comes to the crunch, it is the foreigners who were targeted. And I think that just highlighted the very hard work that still remains to be seen. Now, clearly, there has been progress in certain areas. I know, for example, there are Black people who are thriving in business and, you know, and in the workplace in some of the other big cities like Shanghai and so forth. But challenges still remain. And it raises an important question about what can the African diplomatic corps do for the Africans there. You see, in my story, when these Africans were being driven out of town in Nanjing, many of them headed back to Beijing, where the embassies were, seeking protection from the embassies there. Now, I don't know what support they received and whether it was adequate, but you start to see the same thing happening in 2020. You know, they're looking for what they consider to be the official, you know, protector, the embassy. But I don't know how much protection and how much support was received back then. I'm aware, for example, that the African Union makes various noises every now and then. I think it was the head of WHO who at that time said, you know, China should protect the Africans and so forth. But, you know, when it came down to the crunch, how much was actually possible? What support was actually given to these people? Can the Africans do more? Can the African diplomatic corps do more? I also always get a sense that they're unwilling to rock the boat, and that they could have been more forceful in the way that they seek to assist Africans in need. Perhaps there are issues about not wanting to antagonize a big power that has invested heavily in Africa. I'm speculating. I think it's an area that I think that a topic that we could discuss. But if that had been happening, for example, to British citizens or American citizens, I can assure you that the reaction would have been very different.
So true, so true. We are going for a quick break. Listeners, we are going for a quick break. Don't go away with Professor Ken Kamoche. And our title today, Black Ghosts, which is a fiction writer, but also a management scholar. So don't go away. We'll be back.
This is Colorful Radio. Colorful Radio.
Welcome back. Question is then, where or how far does your writing, or rather passion for writing, go? I mean, it is something you picked up when you grew up, or is it something that goes all the way back when you were a small child?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Julius. As I mentioned earlier, I've been writing ever since I was a kid. I mean, I first got interested in writing because I was reading a lot. You know, my dad used to get me to read everything, you know, all kinds of things, all kinds of books. And then I got into the habit of just writing very short stories in a scrapbook. Some of the very first stories I wrote were, I think, influenced by some of the literature that I read, you know, children's stories, you know, storybooks that, you know, you read in primary school. And you start to think, oh, hang on, I can also create a story. And also because we had this tradition of telling stories at home in the evening after dinner. And you know, the tradition of folk tales, you know, about the hare, the hyena, the ogre, and that sort of thing. And then at some point you start to think, I want to actually commit some of that to paper now that I know how to read and write. That's how I got interested in writing. I wasn't always sure what to write about, but I do remember that in the 70s in particular, there was a lot of talk about gangsters, you know, in Kenya, you know, gangsters running wild, you know, bank robberies were reported all the time. And so that would be in the news as well. And some of the gangsters became almost like legends. And for me, reading, hearing about that, and also reading comics, which were about heroes and, you know, gangsters and the police and criminals, you start to bring the two together and start to think, well, I can create something interesting here. But it was only when I went to secondary school, I went to Nairobi school, and was introduced to not just poetry, but also plays. We used to write, produce, and direct our own plays. And at some point, I remember offering to write a play when I was, I think, in third form for my house. And it was a sort of a humorous take on, I suppose, gangsters who kidnapped somebody. And then they get into a sort of a fight. So it was a fun thing. There were no real big issues surrounding it. But I remember the invigilator at the time saying something to the effect that this play engaged with the light aspects of life. And it seemed to me as though it was a criticism. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, maybe next time I'm going to write something deeper, something serious. So I then started writing a story about these street children in Nairobi, creating a story about how they ended up in the city. You know, what their lives were like, the troubles, the tribulation, the challenges they faced. It never really got published, but I treated it as an opportunity to learn how to write. At the same time, I was writing lots of poetry, so throughout high school and also at university. But I actually started writing a proper novel after my A-levels. And again, that really didn't go very far. It was opportunities. I saw them as opportunities to write. Obviously, it would have been good to have them published, but I think the real serious effort at writing, serious in the sense that it was actually productive, I got things published, was when I moved to Hong Kong and engaged with other aspiring writers. We inspired each other, and I got my very first short stories published in magazines and journals. That's my kind of like my writing story. Always wanted to write, and I still write. I write a lot when I can find the time, especially in the evenings and weekends. So I've actually just finished a novel which is set in colonial Kenya. So hopefully, that's the first draft. So hopefully, we'll find someone to publish it next year. But for now, I'm looking at having the one about warriors. It's not really real warriors, but it's a family that sees themselves as warriors fighting against all kinds of injustices. Hopefully, that will be published later this year. So that's my writing journey. I see myself as a writer. I write academic work, journal articles, books on management, but I also write fiction. And if I didn't write, then I don't know who I would be.
As part of your legacy, it's good to have something to share with the world. And that's why writing is very important. When we come to perhaps your writing and vis-a-vis people who aspire to be writers, what kind of advice can you give them? Because you have lots of people. Yeah, I've got an idea for a book. I've got an idea for a poetry book. All these ideas for film, this and that. But they never get to move. The passion is there, but they never get to move.
Yeah, the passion itself will not get you very far. You have to do the actual writing. And I do get questions. You know, there are, you know, people who write to me and say, oh, I've got this idea for a book, or I've started writing a book. What do you suggest I should do? And I mean, I always say to them, you know, it's obviously good to have an idea. It's a starting point. But then you have to do the actual work. It's like everything else. You know, you have to treat it as it's not just a fun thing, a hobby, if you want to write seriously. I mean, even if you see it as a hobby, it's a side hustle, if you like. But you've got to be very committed, because writing is not easy. It doesn't come easy. Even for, you know, the top writers, they work hard at it. You work hard at your craft. To be able to create a story that is convincing and persuasive, and a story that actually makes sense in terms of plotting, in terms of characterization, in terms of drama, conflict, and all the big themes or minor themes that you want to build and weave into that story, it's hard work. So you have to be able to put in the hours, and it's about consistency. So if you say you're writing a short story or a novel, you know it's going to consume months, years, even. So it's about being consistent. You don't, for example, start writing today and then you put it away for about 3-4 weeks and you say, I'm going to come back to it. It's about consistently writing every day. What I used to do when I was writing Black Ghost is I would talk to my friends, some of whom had lived in China, and they would give me all these tips. They would tell me about all these things that happened, and I would be making a mental note. You know, I'd be filing them away at the back of my mind, and then when I go home, would probably have had a few beers because all of these discussions took place in the bar. But I still felt I needed to sit down at the laptop and write, because if you don't write, then it's not going to get written. I took copious notes. That's important because there are times when you just need to have everything in front of you, you know, notes and boxes with arrows pointing to how you're plotting. It almost looks like a kind of a chemistry experiment that you're doing. So it's about putting in the hard hours and talking to people, talking to fellow writers, aspiring writers, if you like, inspiring each other. And having somebody read your work and comment on it, getting feedback, and constructive feedback, but also being prepared to be receptive to feedback. You see, one of the problems I think people face when they're writing is that they think that everything they've written is sacrosanct; it cannot be changed, and you can easily fall into that trap where you're writing but you don't want to change anything, you don't want to improve it. I think what has helped me is, I believe, by being an academic, because when you're an academic, you write journal articles, you write books, and they go out to peer review. And they'll come back with often very harsh feedback, very harsh comments. If you're not prepared for constructive criticism, you can easily give up. So for me, I think it was beneficial for me interacting with fellow writers and critiquing each other's work and actually going back and thinking, right, okay, I'm going on the wrong trajectory. I need to change. This character is not persuasive. This person is not rounded enough. There's no real story here. You've got to be able to face those realities and go back and write and write and revise and revise. That's what I would say to aspiring writers. So start with an idea. You've got to be passionate about it, because if you don't care about it, you know, it's not going to get done. But it's also about putting in the hard hours. And also reading. I think you can't just be writing and not reading. You've got to read. You've got to be able to read widely. Read all kinds of fiction if you're writing fiction. Learn from the best and see how people craft a story, because writing is about crafting a story. Reading it and asking yourself, does this make sense? Are these characters believable? So I had to think really hard when I was writing this, because I'm locating my characters in Zimbabwe, a country that I had never visited. So everything I know about Zimbabwe is what I've picked up in the media, what I can Google up and what I can view. So writing about a street, today we are blessed with all these technologies. You can go on Google Maps and walk down a street in a city that you've never been, and you get a sense of what it looks like. You then have to go that and translate that into a narrative. It's about talking to people, going to websites by people from that country, see the kinds of things that they're saying on social media. It's about reading, you know, the serious news as well, the serious reputable newspapers, and understanding the issues. Because for me, it was about Africa, China. Why do I want to locate this story in Zimbabwe? There are issues to do with land reform taking place in Zimbabwe when I was writing this story. So I was very up to date and then very active talking to people from Zimbabwe as well, both white and black, who had their own experiences and narratives and stories, some of which were unsurprisingly contradictory and possibly even conflictual. But being able to take that and see, I can use these without necessarily taking people's lives and stories and transferring them onto the laptop. It's using the ideas. And the other thing that I do is writing narrative, writing dialogue, is actually reading it out aloud and seeing if it actually makes sense, and asking yourself, is this the way somebody in that position would speak? Would they use those words? Would they use that level of language? What kind of slang would they use? So there's a lot that goes into it. It's a complete work of art.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At Dermashack, Our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, Dermadew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturiser. So why don't you try our cream, Dermadew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturisation. Dermadew, total body cream, complete moisturisation.
One of my favorite writers I look up to, of course, is Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o. I was privileged one time to interview him for BBC, and I'll never forget that encounter, because sometimes you're going to interview someone, but you don't know their story, and you didn't prepare, you didn't research. And therefore, the first question he asked me, not I should be asking the questions, but he had the right to ask me a question as a journalist. He say, "Right then, have you ever read any of my books?" Just supposing I hadn't. And then I said, "Yes." Oh, I thought it would end there. Which one was the next question? Supposing I hadn't.
Yeah.
Then the next thing is... I said to him, Detained was my favorite book that I read from you. I say, you know, it's okay. You can know the title. Tell me more. What did you like in the book, Detained? So therefore, I was lucky. I had read book, and, you know, a long time ago, and, you know, just some of these characters stuck in my head, everything that was in the book, just stuck in my head. We are meeting with Ngugi almost over 30 years when I read the book. And some of the things were very moving, as you say. The book has to be convincing. It has to resonate with readers, which is very important. That book, you know, took my attention, and really I remember a lot of things about it. So therefore I said to him, one thing I remember very well is a stanza of a poem that you had written. I say, okay, which one? You know, it's not leaving me alone. Can you just imagine all that? Which one? If I was not ready, I would have given up, and I'm like, will you still give me the interview? And Professor Ngugi tells me which stanza. I was lucky again, I remembered, is one of those stanzas, very moving. It was like, it goes something like, while you are alive, don't say never. Security isn't certain, and things won't remain as they are. But when you are beaten down, remember to rise up and fight on. Because those who are defeated today shall be the victors tomorrow. Wow. And when I managed to remember all that, he said to me,
"You've got a good memory."
Yeah, he said to me, you're a good writer, but I haven't written any book. He said to me, just start writing and keep writing. I'm like, why do you say so? He said to me, he who appreciates great work,
yeah,
he definitely can do the same.
Absolutely.
So one day, I hope, I'll get
one
my
day
books
it will be
published.
You talking about your book. Yeah. I was privileged to meet with Ngugi when I was in Hong Kong. At some point, he was visiting.
Yeah, that was my question next to that story was, do you have people you look up to, writers you looked up to?
Yeah. So, yes, I spent a couple of days talking to him. We traveled to Macau, actually. I wanted to see, he was keen to see what Macau was like. So we spent a lot of time talking about fiction, about his work. And obviously I had grown up reading his work, you know, The River Between, Petals of Blood,
and Grain of Wheat,
and so forth. Yeah. So that was a very inspirational for me. I regret I didn't have my phone with me to record. This was before you could record things on the phone, but that would have made for a very interesting interview. But of course, there are writers that you have grown up and looked up to, and they inspire you. You know, people like Wole Soyinka as well. You know, Chinua Achebe, Simbeon Usman. So there has been a generation of African writers who have defined the field, who have written the archetypical African novel, if you like. And they've paved the way, because what has happened is that, you know, the world recognizes that there isn't a single voice, you know, the Western voice. And in fact, one of the things I really appreciate about the way my education panned out in school, I don't know how they do it now, but I worry when I speak to young people who say they, you know, they've not read Shakespeare, or they've not read Dostoevsky, or they've not read Steinbeck, or they've not read Peter Abrahams, is that we were exposed to a very wide range of literatures. So writers from Africa, the African Writer series of the Heinemann books. And then we read books from, well-known Asian writers, North American writers, European writers, and some of the people that I still read today, like Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, people whose stories they still have resonance and relevance even today. We're not even talking about Africa, but even just looking more broadly around the world. And that love for reading is something that is instilled in you from an early age. And that's why I said earlier that, you know, I would ask anybody who says they want to be a writer, you know, they want to write, I would ask them, what have you read recently?
Exactly.
Because you'll find that some people, you know, never read, but they expect to write and to be read, which is a bit of an irony.
Yeah, exactly. That's a key point. I think that's a very important point. You have to appreciate reading to be a good writer, because...
absolutely. And I think that's one of the challenges that I think certainly in Africa I'm finding today, that the love for reading is dissipating, because a lot of young people are on their electronic gadgets. You know, that's what they find easier to do. That's what comes easy to them. You know, your own games, you know, chatting to your friends, you're on social media. How are you then going to go away and write a novel?
It's
not going to happen.
Yeah. You know, if your consumption is TikTok.
I mean, I have certainly found that, writing a short story, I mean, that can consume several weeks or months of your time to make it really work. Writing a novel can take years and years. I mean, if I look at, say, the one that I've just finished now, and the one that is set in colonial Kenya, and the one that kind of looks at the relations between the settlers and the Kenyan population, the workers, people who worked for them, it has taken me, at least 7 years. It's because I don't write full time. I mean, I have a full time job. Perhaps if I was a full time writer, it might take me, a short period of time. Yeah. But the point is that it's a project that grows. It takes on a life of its own. Because what I'm writing now is very different from what I was writing 7 years ago when I first started. The ideas have taken a life of their own. They're new themes. I'm thinking very differently. I may look at some of the characters and think, oh, I don't think I really meant for this person to say that, or to look like that, or to behave as such. So you critique yourself, and that comes with time. And hopefully, it's like when you're creating a sculpture, you shape it, you fine-tune it. You create it into exactly what you want it to be, and that's not going to happen overnight.
Oh yes, it's been great pleasure to host you. Definitely, we will bring you again. We can talk about there are many issues we can tackle in different ways.
Just two things I would say. One is anyone wishing to get a copy of Black Ghost, it will be available. At the publisher's website, which is Austin Macaulay. It's also available in various bookshops in Kenya, as it was published there by Heinemann, East African Education Publishers. But in terms of, and I hope that I'll be able to meet some of your listeners so we can have a debate about these issues, because we're still not seeing enough fiction about the Africa-China nexus. It is still very largely neglected. And yet there are huge communities of Africans now living in Asia. And of course, there are huge, communities of Asians living in Africa. So we need to see a little bit more of that phenomenon explored through fiction, through the arts, through music, through drama, through novels and so forth. And in fact, I would urge people who want to write to start engaging more closely with that narrative, with those stories. And to always remember that, if you want to devote time or your life to writing. You've got to be prepared to make sacrifices. And I mean, there are times when I've had to say no to invitations to, you know, to go to important events because I really needed to finish something. I was really inspired, giving up certain things in order to finish the work, because that's just the way it is. You know, if you want to make it work, then you have to put in the effort. There are no shortcuts to writing fiction. That would be my last word.
Yeah. quite timely.
Yeah.
And very inspiring. I mean, you're doing great work. Keep doing that great work. But it's been a pleasure
having you. Colorful radio.
Ha 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 ha!